Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. On last week's programme, I spoke to Professor David C. Berliner. David Berliner is Regents Professor of Education Emeritus at Arizona State University. He is a member of the National Academy of Education, the International Academy of Education, and a past president of both the American Educational Research Association, AERA, and the Division of Educational Psychology of the American Psychological Association, the APA. He is widely known among teachers as the co-author with Nathaniel Gage of Educational Psychology, and he is a past president of the American Educational Research Association. Our discussion last week ranged over many topics like the declining study of educational psychology in teacher education in the United States and about the messiness of classroom practice. He introduced us to the idea of academic learning time, which he developed and which can be used to predict children's outcomes in school, and he talked about the efforts to make research more accessible to teachers. Earlier in our interview, David Berliner mentioned assessment literacy. So I began this second part of our interview by asking him what assessment literacy means for teachers.
Assessment literacy, teachers need to understand concepts, reliability, validity, instructional sensitivity. That's a concept no teacher understands, and yet they're giving tests. If the items are not instructionally sensitive, they simply won't reflect what you taught. And nobody pays attention to that. The standardized tests never do.
So when you talk about instructional sensitivity, what do you mean by that?
This is a concept Professor Jim Popham and I have been working on for 15 years now. As near as we can tell, there isn't a single test in North America, and I'm going to guess the world, that has ever checked that their items will move if a great teacher taught the unit for which the item is appropriate. So if I'm teaching ecology and I have an item on ecology, if a great teacher taught a unit on ecology, would that item shift from, let's say, 40% passing to 50% passing? If you want to make an inference about teaching, the item has to shift. There is no evidence any of those items do anything but tap social class and past learning. Okay? So we're using tests that are possibly insensitive to instruction. I say possibly because no one will check. Now, we have methods to do that. We have some ideas about how to check for instructional sensitivity, but nobody does it. So teachers need to understand that they're being judged very often by tests that have nothing to do with instruction. They're picking up 10% of the variance in a standardized achievement test can be attributed to teachers. That's it. 90% of the variance is unattributable to the teacher, and they're being held accountable for their scores in the Irish test and the British test, the NAPLAM in Australia and the NAEP in the US. Teachers cannot affect those tests very much. And it's ludicrous that they don't stand up and say, you want to see how I teach? Come into my classroom, watch me for a week. But don't give me the damn test because it's insensitive to what I do.
But I think even teachers will be surprised at what you're saying.
I know. They are when I tell them. I tell them you're being conned, you're being fooled, you're being made a fool of. It drives me crazy that we're using notoriously insensitive tests to tell us how teachers are doing.
But it sounds so counterintuitive even, because, I mean, surely, as you give the example about ecology, if you're teaching something about plants and you do a before and after test, surely you would expect to see an improvement after testing the unit.
I'm not talking teacher tests, okay? Sean, let's understand it. The teacher's test will reflect what the teacher taught. The standardized achievement test will not. Okay, there's a big difference here. The teacher's test, if a smart, caring teacher builds items related to what they actually taught, then you're likely to get a teacher effect.
So is it because the standardized tests are too generic?
They have a number of faults. One of which is that it's the desired curriculum that they're testing, not the enacted curriculum. Teachers close their classroom door, and what do they teach? 50% of what's desired? Maybe less? Maybe something else? Something happens? Something blows up in the world, or there are migrants coming in? And the teacher will spend a couple of weeks on that. Perfectly justifiable, because kids have migrants moving into the school. Nothing wrong with that, except the social studies test might have nothing on that. So the desired curriculum and the actual taught curriculum are worlds apart. We have studies in the U.S., very detailed curriculum logs from teachers of what they taught hour by hour, and the tests that are given to judge the teachers. And the correlation between the two is about 0.13. There hardly exists at all. And we have multiple studies in which all the correlations are under 0.2. Well, how can you make a judgment about a teacher from that? Or how can the teachers let themselves be judged when the tests are so awful? The teacher should say, here's my test, here's my kids' answers. Looks like they're doing good on the stuff I'm teaching.
So it's the tests that need to change then?
Oh, yeah.
So why have we become so fascinated by standardized tests?
We have a society that's gone for metrification. The economists and business leaders use these metrics. They have dominated in a neoliberal world. Business and economists have become the superstars of the newspapers. We quote our business people and our economists. We don't quote humanists. We don't quote English literature majors and people. Along with metrification comes a kind of talismanic belief in numbers, that these numbers have special powers. And they're numbers. They don't have the meaning people give them. 72, that's a lot higher than 70. Well, probably not on a test, given that we have standard errors. So these polls that, you know, Trump is up over Clinton by 5 percentage points, that's well within the margin of error. It was a small poll. People don't understand that people are reifying numbers. And numbers are man-made. They have all error problems. And we live in an age where numbers are important. So the standardized test has taken huge importance because of the logic. A parent says, well, you taught my kid. You gave him a test. He didn't do well on the test. Either my kid is a dummy or you're a terrible teacher. What other choice do I have? How about the third choice, which is the test is absolutely unreflective of what I taught your kid? There's a third choice there.
Or is there a fourth? Should the teacher focus on teaching towards the test?
Well, that's a fourth choice. You're quite right. And that's what a lot of teachers end up doing. And they're boring the kids. They're doing test prep. That's the Korean way. That's the Chinese way. And they're all dissatisfied with their school systems. They get high test scores on the PISA, for example. But the kids are a mess. And Korean kids commit suicide at high rates. The Chinese kids are not entrepreneurial. They're not democratic. They're conforming. I don't know the Irish system, but in the U.S., we're producing kids who are terrific at age 25 and 30. They're just not very good at age 15. So we're producing entrepreneurial, creative adults with our social systems of how to raise children. Baseball, football, all those things that no Chinese kid has ever heard of.
But you can't measure entrepreneurship on a test.
No, but if you look at the number of 25-year-olds who created a company last year, the U.S. may lead the world on that. So we're doing something right. In fact, there is something called the Getty Index, the Global Entrepreneurial Development Index. And no one in the U.S. talks about it, but we're number one in the world by far for both males and females. By far, okay? But on the PISA test, we're mediocre. Well, which would you rather have? Adults as entrepreneurs as a predictor of future economic growth, or 15-year-olds that don't give a damn about the test? I'll tell you where I put my money on predicting the U.S. future. It's on adults creating businesses.
So you don't have much time then for these international tests like TIMSS and PIRLS and PISA and so on?
You know, any test that is reliable and has a sense of at least some validity to tell us something about what we're interested in can be used for conversations. But as high stakes or as policy, I'd hesitate to design policy over it. I mean, why are Irish kids different than German kids? Well, that's a good question to ask and talk about and then make a judgment. We like our Irish kids. They're okay. The German kids can do what they want and the Korean kids can do what they want. It's their culture. Let them do it. But our Irish kids are okay. And when they're adults, they're law-abiding. They vote. Maybe they're going into business. I mean, the question is, what are your adults like? Not what your 15-year-olds are like on TIMSS or PISA. And OECD has conned us into believing 15-year-olds are predicting the future. And economists are talking about that. Eric Hanuschek and Wurzmer in Germany say if you build your education system better, you will have $1 trillion more in your economy. I think they're nuts. I think if you raise a whole bunch of creative, healthy kids, your economy will grow.
And do you think standardized tests have any role in schools then?
Yeah. The NAPLA in Australia, the NAEP in the US, they give you an idea of how the system is doing over years on stuff most people agree should be in the curriculum. So if you do an eighth grade math test, but testing every kid every year on standardized tests is nonsense. But testing certain grades, fourth, eighth, 10th, having markers for how they're doing on stuff we generally think should be in the curriculum, and looking over time how we're doing on that, I don't see anything wrong with that. That's feedback for the system. But if you're talking about firing superintendents or firing teachers or making high-stakes decisions, that's a big mistake. When No Child Left Behind came across in the United States, my colleague Sharon Nichols and I wrote a book called Collateral Damage, How High-Stakes Testing Threatens American Education. And everything we predicted was true. I mean, you cannot run a system on high-stakes standardized tests. It's just too far removed from the life of teachers in classrooms. So if the stakes aren't high, use the information for good conversations. How come China's beating us on these tests? Well, let's talk about their socialization of children to life and our socialization. Our kids are playing baseball. Their kids are studying. Well, why shouldn't they beat us?
In that book, Collateral Damage, I mean, you talk about how testing corrupts professional education. I mean, that's quite a strong word. How does it corrupt professional
education? It corrupts
education?
Because you use it wrong. Again, if I give a test that is reasonably reliable, valid for certain purposes, but mostly for conversations, and invalid for making judgments about teachers and schools. So the validity is fine. Let's take the VAMs we use in the United States. You know, you test fourth grade, you test fifth grade, look at the growth over the year, and you say some teachers are high, some teachers are low. That is so subject to who's in the class that year. So if I have two more English language learners, my scores are going to go down. If I have two more students of college-educated parents, my scores are going to go up. That has nothing to do with me as a teacher. Okay? So the VAMs are notoriously difficult to pin on a teacher. On the other hand, if I have one teacher A and teacher B, and the VAMs are quite different, I need to hold a conversation. And if I have four VAMs in a row where the teacher is terrible, I need to be sure that that conversation has validity, that the teacher says, well, I had extra English language learners because I speak in my country. I speak Spanish fluently, so they load me up with the English language learners. Well, that's a perfectly legitimate reason for low VAMs, okay? But if I don't have a teacher who can explain away 4 years of low VAMs, that's a teacher to fire. So if I have enough data, I could use it. But one test is crazy, and without a conversation about what might be the causes, it's just crazy to make judgments like that.
And you were a dean of education at Arizona State University. How do you think education programs should decide whether somebody is a competent beginning teacher or not?
I was very proud. I don't know how they do it today, but I was very proud that during my deanship, while I didn't get some of the things I wanted in, since there's something called the faculty that has to vote, and I could not be the czar I wanted to be. We failed or counseled out or somehow suggested leaving about 10% of the students in our teacher ed program. And I was very proud of that. I mean, these are people we thought, you really shouldn't be a teacher. So we got rid of about 10%. During student teaching, we got rid of another 3-4%. So the teachers we were sending out to the field at least had been vetted reasonably well for competency, for moral kinds of reasons. We had some weirdos want to be teachers, we get them out. I thought we did very well, and I think most teacher ed programs do this pretty well. But beyond that, we can't make good predictions about who'll be a good teacher, I don't think. Now we need good placements, that's always a problem for student teaching. But the turn in the U.S., when I said that we got rid of all these social science and courses and history and the humanities, what we replaced them with is clinical work, field work. And that's not a bad thing, okay? So while they took away stuff I would want to see in the curriculum, they also replaced it with something quite worthwhile, which is more time in classrooms, more time in schools that are specially set up for new teachers. That's not all bad. Clinical work's real important, medicine being a perfect example. You end up, 2 years of stuff in classrooms, but then you do like 4 years of clinical work in the U.S. And we're doing that more and more. And it's not a bad way to make judgments about teachers. Our problem is we're getting alternative certified teachers who have none of that, including Teach for America, 5 weeks training. These people, that's a scam. That's nonsense. The only people who will hire a Teach for America teacher is a poor school district that can't pay salaries well and doesn't care if their low-income kids gets a teacher will be there for two years, in which the churn rate is going to be very high and no stability. It's a horrible situation.
Would you recommend somebody you cared about today to become a teacher?
Yes. My son is a professor. My daughter works in educational research. My wife and sister-in-law are teachers. One of my nieces is a teacher. The question is, how much money must you have to live a decent life? And teacher salaries certainly aren't good for college-educated people who often with a master's degree. The salaries are not good, but on the other hand, the life you used to lead was very good, including summers off, ability to take care of kids. You can get out at 3 o'clock and make sure you're with your kid. There were lots of benefits. Today, the salaries have not grown commensurate with the responsibility of teachers. They're not growing as well in the salary scale, and the top has been hurt. And life you led is denigrated by the society because people keep talking about how bad teachers are and how awful they are and how they're hurting everything. I'm not sure it's as good a life as it was. And on the other hand, it depends on, if you have a calling, you have a calling, okay? And we're very lucky we still get an awful lot of people with a calling. And
it's
blessed.
Almost an old-fashioned idea, isn't it? A calling.
A calling, yeah. I mean, particularly women, they older sister teaches younger sister to read, and she's headed to be a teacher. She loved it. She found it out. My wife's older sister taught my wife to read, so my wife entered school reading because her older sister was learning to read and taught her how to read.
But that's bringing up something else. Why do you think young men are not interested in teaching them?
Well, to
the same extent, anyway.
I have no answer, but I just thought of my wife one day buying a videotape of mechanical things on farms. And it was the stupidest video I had ever seen, and my grandson watched it 100 times. Boys like big things that crash, okay? I raised a boy and a girl. They're different, okay? Not every boy, not every girl, but in general, there's a nurturing side to girls. They have a doll and they play mother. And boys want trucks that bang into each other. And, you can deny it, but I can't in my family. That's the way it was. And it seems to me I think I'm a nurturing male, but I like trucks and things that go bang too. And so I think that's part of the difference.
I did a course in writing. It was a graduate course given by a guy called Bruce McPherson, but he gave one piece of advice on co-authoring, and he said, don't do it.
Yeah.
Now, you are somebody who
just
has...
the opposite.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. It's a rule you've broken consistently.
Yes.
So what is the secret to successful co-authoring?
Well, first of all, the reason I do it is guilt is a great motivator. Maybe it's my Jewish background, but there are lots of Catholics live with guilt all the time, too. If you owe a paper and you're late, as everybody almost is, wouldn't it be nice to have a co-author who says, come on, give me your piece of it? So I did it out of necessity. I was procrastinating, I wasn't getting anything done, and I'm a social human being. And I like working with others, my students, my colleagues. I was Gage's junior on the Ed Psych Techs. We spent every Friday and Saturday together for 5 years. I took off work on Fridays. We worked Friday, Saturday for 5 years from 1970 to 75 to get our book out. And I loved it. I was with a wonderful man. We talked of life and love and books and wrote. And if you're a social being, I would say find a good co-author and work with them. It's more fun because they prod you and they stretch you, of course, if you pick the right ones. I mean, the people I've worked with all stretched me. It's wonderful.
Why are you visiting Ireland at this time?
Because I was asked to give a talk at in Limerick at Mary Immaculate College. They have a little summer research seminar. My topic was how standardized achievement tests cannot be used to judge teachers. And this was a group of principals and associate superintendents and young leaders in education. And I said, I don't know why you accept a metric that's no good. This metric is no good. You should not give it. And if teachers will band together, they'll take it away. But like the opt-out movement in the US, parents finally said, enough, I'm keeping my kid home, let him read a book, enough testing. And some districts go crazy and say, you can't do that, we'll fail your child. They can't fail your child for staying home. Florida is suing some parents because they won't let their kids take the test. If you stand up together, you change the world. If you're just complacent, as teachers so often are, William James in 1897, 1903, I forget, he was on tour with his new book, Talks to Teachers. And he went on tour and he talked about teachers just swallow everything you tell them. It drove him crazy. And I don't think it's changed in 100 years. Teachers, you know, if you say, well, you got to give the test, then you got to give the test. How about saying no? Some kindergarten teachers refused to give the test in Florida at one of the school districts. I forget which one. And at the school board meeting, this teacher stood up and said, this is against my professional practice. I will not punish my kindergarten kids with this kind of test. And the school board member said, well, we'll have to fire you then. And another kindergarten teacher stood up and said, I'm not going to give it either. Then they all stood up. They took away the test. There's a lesson here.
Okay. You seem to worry a lot about the future of schools in the United States. Would that be right?
Well, I do, but I temper that by saying everybody's worried about the schools, and they have been since colonial times. They're always sure the new generation's no good. The business community has always condemned whoever we turn out. I have headlines going back to 1880 in which the students of today are no damn good, and they can't make change, and they can't work. I mean, this is what old people always say about young people, so I temper it all with my historical understanding that from Socrates in 500 BC, old people have been condemning young people. You know what? Old people don't understand young people. And young people, with any luck, you're in a dynamic society, and young people are going to be different than old people. And instead of accepting that, we usually condemn it.
So you've written particularly about the global education reform movement, or GERM.
GERM.
Yeah, so does that give you cause for concern, or what is that even?
Well, again, it's what I mentioned before about metrification and the power of the business community and economists to shape the way we think about the world. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing schools in the service of the business community. One time in the U.S., schools were in the service of the clergy. The U.S. schools were all run by sons and daughters and brother-in-laws of clergymen in order to prepare people for some form of Protestant or Catholic service. And now we're in the corporate era. And what we're seeing is the corporatization of the reform movement. Schools are now no longer training people for the factories, but they're training people for corporate life. And, you know, schools should not be vocational. They ought to be about preparing people for a rich and happy life as best you can, one piece of which is employability. Instead, it's the employability. In Ireland, I keep hearing about, you know, preparing people for the business world. Ireland cannot survive without kids ready to take their place in the business world. Ireland won't survive if you don't have kids who are thoughtful. That's a different view of it. And you take your chances with thoughtfulness. I don't know if they'll be prepared for industry or not, but I put my money on a thoughtful person will do well in business.
You talk about teachers needing to speak up more, but is it that just the voice of teachers is muted in societies?
Well, I think it is, but in the U.S. we have 3.5 million teachers, mostly are in the NEA, National Education Association, or the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, and I personally think both groups have sold out teachers. They so want a place at the table that they are not militant enough. There are other countries where that's not true, And I think American teachers have been shafted by George Bush and that No Child Left Behind Act. And unions should have just said, no, that's the wrong metric. If you want to spend $1,000, we can really do a good job evaluating our teachers. But if you want to spend $40 for a standardized test, you can't do it well. And I'm sorry. You need to visit classrooms. Maybe you need to take away tenure and give 5-year licenses or something. But go visit them and see how they teach. And if you had board certified teachers, we have a board certification system in the U.S. that's wonderful, I think. And if you get the board certified teachers who are acknowledged to be really good in their field as visitors to classrooms a couple of times a year, and let them make the judgments on their fellow people. Like inspectors, yeah. And the inspectorate system has all the warts of a human system, but the standardized tests may have more warts.
Finally, David, who or what inspires you?
Oh, boy. I don't know a good answer to that. But maybe my father. In a funny way, I was just thinking about him recently, and passed away many years ago. I had a wonderful childhood, lovely parents, loving, not particularly wealthy, not wealthy at all, as a matter of fact. But he was such a moral man, and he was a member of the Democratic Party because you needed to take care of working people. Corporations would steal from you, or they would rob you, or they would fire you. And I guess I got a little bit of socialism or Democratic Party put into my brain. Not that they always do what I would like, but the notion that little people have to stand together and fight a system that often goes wrong, that's my father's training, I realized. He wasn't very talkative, but he was very moral and modeled those things for me. I think I'm his son, and that feels good.
And that tribute from David Berliner to his father brings to a close my interview with him. I'm grateful to David for taking the time out during his vacation in Ireland to do the interview. If you like what you heard in today's programme, please tell your friends about the programme by sharing links to it on social media like Twitter and Facebook. You will find links to hundreds of podcasts of previous programmes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. You can get in touch with me by emailing feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. But until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.